those who have an actual house, Haggadah, we're up to page 10 and 11. Last time we met, 2 weeks ago, we introduced the four sons. And unlike today, full house.
It's so proud of you. It's
already. So we got a nice full house today. It's nice to see. Yeah, right. So last time we introduced the four sons, and I want to do today is try to analyze a little bit the four sons. What is the message of the four sons, the Haggadah? How does the Torah's presentation of the four sons differ from the Haggadah's presentation of the four sons? Because the Torah presents them in a different way than the Haggadah presents them. Which they compare and contrast. Why does the Haggadah present the four sons differently than the Torah presents them? So just as another quick introduction to the four sons, the Torah in four places discusses children asking questions to their parents about Passover, in one way or the other. And the Torah never delineates which question belongs to which type of child. So we're all familiar with the four sons, the wise, the wicked, the simple, and the one who doesn't know how to ask. But the Torah never tells you, here's the question of the wise son, here's the question of the wicked son. The Torah just gives you four questions, and the rabbis, in their wisdom, were able to decipher and discern which question belongs to which type of child. Because if the Torah repeats something four times, obviously there's a different perspective on each question. Because the Torah's not going to say the same question with a similar or different answer four times in different places in the Torah. There must be some contrast between the four questions, which leads us to the idea of the four different kinds of children, the four sons. What's fascinating, which we'll try to do today, is to try to contrast. When the Torah gives you the question and the answer, often it's not the same answer the Haggadah seems to give. And the Haggadah obviously is modeling itself after the Torah. So why would it be that the author of the Haggadah, we're not sure exactly who wrote the Haggadah, but it was one of the rabbis of the Mishnaic times, called the Tana. So this was written in the Tanaic period. We're dealing here between approximately in the year, 300 BCE, around there, 200 BCE, that time, I don't know the exact dates, but that time frame of history. And that's when the Haggadah was authored. But yet, the responses seem to have a difference from the response the Torah gives. So I want to try to understand each son, how the Torah presents his question, how the Torah presents the answer to the question, and where the Haggadah draws its answer to the question. So we'll begin with the wise son. But it's important for us just to note beforehand that the mitzvah given to us, the Torah words the idea of telling the story of the Exodus as we should teach our children on that night that God took us out of Egypt. It's the idea of teaching our children. But yet it's very clear that whether you have a child to teach or not, you have a mitzvah to talk about the story of the Exodus. It's not only teaching children, it's teaching ourselves. Even if all of us sitting there by themselves, God forbid, sitting by yourself, basically, they'll never be by yourself on Pesach. They'll be terrible to have you by yourself. But if someone is by themselves on Pesach night, with no one around, no friends, no family, still a mitzvah to tell yourself the story. So the mitzvah has nothing to do with teaching a child in its essence. The mitzvah is to recite the story of the Exodus on Pesach night.
Do you need a minyan or a public forum to do that?
No. It could be even somebody on their own would have the obligation. Obviously, it's best to be with family and friends, etc. But even on your own, you have the obligation of telling the story of the Exodus. So when the Torah words it as a child, there's a concept that what does a child represent to us? A child is always ready for knowledge. A child is ripe for learning. A child is curious. A child is open. As we get older, we kind of close ourselves off sometimes. And we're not so interested. You know, we can't teach the old dog new tricks, you know, as they say. But the idea of a child is that we have a child is somebody who always wants to learn, is open for learning, is open for growth. And on Pesach, we all have to have the attitude of a child. Every single Jew on Pesach should approach the Haggadah as a child, that we are curious, we want to know, we want to take in information, absorb it, let it affect us. So when we talk about the mitzvah as teaching a child, that can refer to an adult as well, because we should have the attitude of children on Pesach night, that we're ready to absorb new information. The Mishnah tells us that the parents teach the child based on their wisdom, meaning that every single individual learns differently, and we have to be able to teach every individual on their level, based on who they are, based on their background, based on their attitudes, and that goes again for children and adults. All of us have our own way that we approach learning, way we approach wisdom, all of us have different backgrounds, all of us have different ways in which we approach the Torah. And the mitzvah of the Haggadah is to be able to take the information and relate it on every single level to every person based on their own wisdom, based on their own standing in life. And when we talk about four children, four different types, it doesn't mean four different people necessarily. Often I understand it to mean that every person in themselves has all different attitudes. We have part of ourself that is wicked, unfortunately. We all have that part. We have part of ourself that is wise. We have part of ourself that is simple. We have part of ourself that is either unable or not interested in asking. No, those four sons coexist in every single individual Jewish person. And we have to be able to approach every single part of ourselves and teach every aspect of ourselves on Seder night. We have to draw in our entire being on Seder night. So the wise part of a person, you draw in a certain way. And that rebellious part of ourselves, we draw in a different way. And that simple part of ourselves, the part of ourselves which wants to remain very simple, we don't want to get involved, we have to draw that part in a different way. And there's a part of ourselves which doesn't know how to ask, we have to draw that part in a different way. But all four parts of every single person, we want to be able to draw in. So the four sons may be four individual people, but also they can all coexist in every person. And I think all of us have all four of those parts in ourselves. So when the Haggadah portrays the four sons, it's teaching us this is how you have to teach the Haggadah. Teach the Haggadah in four different ways so that every single type of person, every single part of an individual person, the different compartments in ourselves, will be able to relate. So let's begin with the order. The order in the Haggadah is, well, I'm on page 11. The law speaks on the Maxwell House Haggadah. There's another one floating around. It's a different print. But in the Maxwell House one, it is page 11. The law speaks distinctly of the four different sorts of children, the wise, the wicked, the simple, and the one who does not know how to inquire. So there's an interesting thing here, which is the order. The order, as we know in the Haggadah, is wise, wicked, simple, and the one who does not know how to inquire. As we said, every single one of these sons is mentioned in the Torah, and the Torah portrays them in a different order. The order of the Torah, the first one mentioned in the Torah is the wicked son. Then comes the son who does not know how to ask. Then comes the simple, and then comes the wise. So it's a very different order in the Torah than it is in the Haggadah. Why would the author of the Haggadah change the order? We would think we should take in the order of the Torah.
What is the order of the Haggadah?
The order of the Haggadah is wise, wicked, simple, and the one who does not know how to ask. The order in the Torah is wicked, the one who does not know how to ask, simple, and then wise. That's the order of the Torah. So why would... The Torah's order is the wicked, if I stay there I can use the board, but it's too far away. Wicked, the one who does not know how to ask, simple, and wise.
Those are the Where in Torah is that?
What?
Where in Torah is that?
So there's four different places. Three of them are found in Parshas Bo, in the book of Shmos, and the fourth one is found in Parshas Vayeschanan, in Devarim. So the three out of four are in Parshas Bo, and the fourth one is in Parshas Vayeschanan.
They make mention of the sons in each one of those places.
No, so there's four mentions of four sons. It doesn't tell you, it doesn't give a label. It doesn't say this is the wise one. But there's four times in Torah where it talks about sons asking questions
and
about
them. In the same order in the Torah?
What?
In the Torah where it refers to them, it always goes, those four times, it's always goes the same
way. That's what I'm saying. The Torah, there's four times, it mentions one son. The Torah mentions one son four times. See what I'm saying? It mentions one son in Shmos Exodus 12. And it mentions another one in Shmos 13. Another one in Shmos 13 again. And then another one in Devarim 6. So four times it's mentioned, they sign up
for your
question.
When your child asks you on that day.
Yeah, right.
Where your child asks you, but it doesn't say what kind of child. And when we get this order, what we're really saying is the way the Torah phrases the question and the response, rather, the way the Torah phrases the question, this is the way. Haggadah, this one is associated with the
wife. Right. The rabbis in the Haggadah associate each question with the kind of son, exactly. But why would the Haggadah present these sons in a different order than the Torah presents them? That's the question I want to address here. So the Maral writes that the Torah's order is very specific. Maral, Rabbi Yehuda Alowi of Prague, one of the famous deep commentators on many parts of the Torah, including the Haggadah, so he writes that there is a famous verse in the book of Psalms, Tehillim, Sur Meirah Vaseh Tov. We first want to cast off the evil, then do good. The approach to connecting with God is that first you cast aside bad traits, bad habits, and then you start working on improving yourself and doing better things. So Maharal says the order of the Torah is based on that concept. First you want to deal with the wicked son. You cast away the evil. Then you have the one who does not know how to ask, who is kind of, you know, neutral. Then you have the simple son. He's the one who you need to kind of bring up to the next level. And the wise son, you're going to bring him into a higher level. So it's the order of casting off the evil and then moving towards the good. That's how the Maharal describes the order of the Torah. However, in the Haggadah, we change the order. Why we change the order of the Haggadah? So the Abu Draham, is another early commentator, he writes that the Haggadah lists them in the order of their wisdom. The wise son is the wise son, he's first. The wicked son's very wise. We discussed last time we spoke. The wicked son could be just as wise as the wise son. He just has a bad attitude towards wisdom. The simple son we look at as not as wise, and then the one who does not know how to ask, classically, is the one who doesn't have the capacity to ask. That's someone who, either the young child, or someone who doesn't have any information, someone who's ignorant. That's the fourth son. So he says that the order of the Haggadah is going in order of their wisdom. So that explains the two orders. Now, why the Haggadah chose to change the order, I don't have an answer to that question. We know what the logic behind two orders, but why the Haggadah chose to change it, I don't know. But that's something we can all think about. But the order of the Torah is trying to cast away the evil and move towards the good. The order of the Haggadah is trying to go from the wisest to the least wise. That's how we view the two orders. If anyone has any thoughts on why the author of the Haggadah would change it, I'm open for suggestions. But, you know, that's an interesting thought, but then I would probably put the simple before the wicked at that point. You want the wicked to be last and let all the positive information. He's smart. Right, then he's in good shape. Okay, maybe. It's definitely a thought. Definitely a thought. So, but that's the difference between the orders, which is interesting. Now, I want to try to look at the answers the Torah gives, the answers that the Haggadah gives. Now, had I had time, if I wasn't traveling less, I would have made a chart, but I didn't have time for that. So, we'll have to just listen. That's true. An airplane is the struggle of am I going to go to sleep or not. You know, that's usually what I'm dealing with on the airplane. But what? Yeah. Well, they both eventually conked out on the airplane. And as hard as it was, they conked out. But I was the one who was tossing and turning. So we'll try to go through each one. So that we have the way that God presents the wise son. The wise son is the first one in the Haggadah. What does the wise child ask? So now this is a quote from the Torah. This quote comes from the book of Devarim, Deuteronomy chapter 6. And it says, what are these testimonies, statutes, and judgments that the Eternal our God has commanded you? So the exact way the Torah phrases that question is, Ki shalcha ben chamachar limer. When your son asks you tomorrow or in the future, saying, my Eidos, here comes the question, my Eidos, v'chukim, my shvatim, what are these testimonies and statutes and laws that Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem our God, has commanded you? And then the Torah, so the Haggadah responds to him, let's compare and contrast now. The Haggadah responds to the wise child, you will respond by instructing the child in the laws of Passover, teaching that after the Paschal lamb is eaten, there is to be no dessert. Just to explain what that means, you know, we don't nowadays have the sacrifice, the Paschal lamb, the Pesach sacrifice. However, the law about that sacrifice was, it was eaten at the end of the meal, and once the sacrifice was eaten, there was no more food eaten after that. You're not allowed to eat anything else that night. We've modeled the Afikoman after the Paschal lamb, and we also have a law that after you eat the Afikoman on Pesach night, you shouldn't eat anything else. The only thing you should eat afterwards would be the last two cups of wine. But after those last two cups of wine, you should leave the flavor of the Afikoman in your mouth till the morning. That's the concept. So that's our model, is the Afikoman. But in their days, they would eat the sacrifice. The meal sacrifice is their final part of the meal. And after that, no more food. Yeah?
When we eat that at the end, is that considered dessert or not considered dessert? And why I ask you that, because growing up in Philadelphia, at Hebrew school, they said, that's your dessert. So set me straight.
Yeah, I think that the word afikoman itself, according to some, means dessert. That's what it means. Yeah, that's what some say it means.
Yeah, but we still eat real dessert before that dessert.
Yeah. Right.
And what's your address?
So the Haggadah answers the wise child with the answer, teaching the laws of Passover, that a very intricate detail of Passover. After you eat the Paschal lamb, no dessert after that. If you want any more dessert, have it before, like Sue was saying. But nothing after. Now, in contrast, the Torah's answer to him is a long answer, which we'll get to in a second. But I want to focus on the question. As we said, the Torah does not label each question. But we have to figure out, how does the author of the Haggadah know that this question is a question of a wise child? So there's a few different points here. Number one is that the wise child's question is very elaborate, very complex, meaning he's showing his wisdom and his intelligence through his question. Because he is able to categorize. He says, I see in front of me lots of stuff going on. We're eating matzah, we're having bitter herbs, we're telling a story, we're having a Pesach sacrifice, we destroy all of our chametz, and we bake matzahs, we do all these interesting things for the Yontif. Now, we know that mitzvahs come in different categories. And we may mention this back in the past, but some mitzvahs are what we call eidos. It was the first part of this question. Eidos, the translator's testimonies, and that we would describe, based on many commentaries, as symbolic mitzvahs. So, for instance, eating matzah. It's symbolic of something beyond the actual piece of cracker that we're eating. It's symbolism. Keeping Shabbos is symbolism. The guy created the world in 6 days, rested on the seventh day. So we call that a symbolic mitzvah, so we understand what it means. The specifics, why 18 minutes, and why flour and water, and why this way, and why that way, and why can't I separate on Shabbos or drive my car, those things may not be as easily understood. But the concept overall is that Shabbos is symbolic of God resting. Matzah is symbolic of freedom or slavery. Bitter herbs are symbolic of bitterness. Those are things which we call symbolic mitzvahs. The next thing he asks is translated here as statutes. The Hebrew word is chukim. And chukim, we refer to a mitzvah which we don't understand at all. It does not seem to be rational, such as the classic examples would be not eating milk and meat together. Or the Torah's the paradigm of a chok is the red cow, paraduma. Makes no sense how it works. The mitzvahs that don't make any sense to the human mind, don't seem to be symbolic of anything, at first glance just seem to be strange, those we call a chok. Mishpatim is the third one mentioned, as translated here as judgments. But mishpatim means mitzvahs which are very rational and contribute to society in ways we understand, such as don't steal, don't murder, love your neighbor as yourself. These are mitzvahs which we would call mishpatim, because these mitzvahs are very obvious why God commanded them. Even societies that aren't privy to the Torah, they also enact these laws because they make sense. Those are mishpatim. So the wise child understands the mitzvahs come in different categories, and the wise child asks the question in that way. He says, I see in front of me lots of different things happening. I understand that they can be categorized in different ways, because he's wise and able to discern that, but I want to understand more about them. And he says to his father, what are these different types of mitzvos, the different types of commands that Hashem, our God, has commanded you? And he also mentions Hashem, our God. I mean, he's including himself in the Jewish people. He says, he's our God. I'm part of this too. And I understand we have lots of commands. And explain to me what they all mean. And that's the way he asks the question. So that's how we know this is a wise child asking the question. Now let's compare the Torah's response to the God's response. The Torah's response is actually a long response. And again, it's not printed in the Haggadah, because not in the Haggadah, it's only in the Torah. And the Torah's response is, V'amartu levincha, you should tell your son, Avadu ayinu lefar mitzrayim, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. V'yotzi'inu Hashem mitzrayim biyad chazaka, and God took us out of Egypt with a strong hand. V'yitin Hashem oso semovsim, he made wonders and great miracles in Egypt, in front of Pharaoh, and his household, in front of our eyes. V'asar osimishim, he took us out of there, in order to bring us to this land which God has sworn to your ancestors, the land of Israel. And God has commanded us to follow these chukim. The word chok there, that's the one that's not rational. He's commanded to follow these chukim. Liras Hashem lokeinu, to fear Hashem our God. Latov lanu kol yomim, to do good for us all of our days. L'chayosinu, to give us life. K'imazeh, as of this day. L'tzedakah etzielon, it'll be tzedakah for us. It'll be good for us. K'nishmer lasos, if we were to guard to do all of the commands of God before Hashem our God as he commanded us. It's a very long response to the Torah to the wise son. So how do we understand the difference between the Torah's response to the Haggadah's response? They seem to be quite different. So there's one key word here in the Haggadah which is lost in translation, but if you look at the Hebrew, for those who are familiar with it, it says the af ata emor lo. Af. What does af mean? You know what af means?
Nose.
Also means nose. What else could it mean? That's true. Af could also mean also. Af. Af also. Also you tell him the laws of Passover. Meaning the Haggadah understands, of course you're going to give him the answer the Torah says, but add to it as well. So the word af in the Haggadah is teaching you that there's two responses to the wise son. Number one, tell him the Torah's answer. Because of course that's the correct answer. The Torah says that's the answer to the wise son. But also, add on to that, afterwards, the laws of Passover, such as no dessert after the Paschal lamb. So that's what we understand how these two fit together. The word af is teaching you, say that answer, plus add in this answer. Now let's understand what this answer is. What is the answer to the wise son? So again, I wish I had a copy for you so you can look at the text in front of you. But the answer the Torah gives to the wise son is really has two parts to it. The first part is a general approach. It says, God took us out of Egypt with great miracles. He created plagues upon Pharaoh and his household. And he took us out and brought us to the land of Israel. That's number one. So that's the general approach to Passover. Number one, you should know, Pesach is all about the fact that God took us out of Egypt with miracles, with divine intervention. And then the father answers, according to the Torah, the wise son, that God's commanded us to do all of these chukim. So we mentioned before, the wise son divided the laws into three categories. There are testimonies, symbolic mitzvos, that was one. There's chukim, the mitzvos that don't have any rationale. And there's mishpatim, mitzvos that are very, very logical and make a lot of sense to us. But when the father responds, he doesn't respond addressing each category. He says, God commanded us to do all of these chukim, all of these laws that seem to be not rational. All these laws seem to be strange, that we don't understand. So why is that the response to the wise son? So many commentaries point out, the very first thing you tell your wise son is that, you know, my dear son, you're very, very wise. And the way you ask your question is very, very complex, very intricate. It makes a lot of sense. But the first thing you have to know is, wise as you are, you'll never understand God fully. And even the mitzvah, which seems as logical as it could be, and as rational as could be, even that should be approached as a chok. That should be approached as something which you're just following and you're obeying orders, because ultimately we never understand God. And as wise as you are, as much as you can delve into the depths of the Torah, at a certain point you're going to say, this is all a chok to me. Because everything, from God's perspective, is far beyond us. So we have to let the wise son not get carried away with his wisdom. We don't want him to become arrogant, think he understands it all. We tell him, number one, everything should be approached basically as a chok. Of course, you delve into it, as we discussed many times before, to try and understand it to the best of your ability. But don't get carried away and think you're so smart and so wise. We treat it all as a chok. Everything should be treated just as a mitzvah, which is irrational, which is that I do as I'm ordered. I trust that God knows best for me. And finished. And then he goes on and he says that we have to fear God, and it'll be good for us all of our days. I mean, all these mitzvahs that we do, whether you understand it or not, it's good for you. Because it came from God. And often you go to the doctor and they'll give you a certain medication or a certain therapy or procedure and you don't understand what it's doing and why I have to do this. But hopefully you trust in your doctor. You say, you're the doctor, you know best. And even though I understand why you're telling me to do such a thing, I'll trust you that's going to be beneficial for my health. So God, obviously, it's for sure like that. God says, do X, Y, and Z. And I say, I don't understand what that's going to do for me. I don't know why it's good. But we tell the wise son, you have to understand, whether you understand it or not, it's all good for you. Because if God commanded it, we know it's the right thing. We know it's going to give you life. It's tzedakah and it's tzedakah for you. It's God's generosity. God's giving us good things if we do all of his mitzvos. So he gives the wise son a general perspective on all mitzvos. The first thing you have to know is that all mitzvos are good for you. Whether you are so wise, you know that there's categories and there are testimonies and there are statutes and there are laws. And some things are rational, some are irrational. You know that. But don't get carried away with your thoughts and your wisdom. Don't think you're so smart. Know that everything is from God. Ultimately, we don't know why God does what he does, but it's all good for us. And that has to be our response to all mitzvahs overall. That's our approach. And that's how we approach the wise son. So number one, we tell the wise son, God took us out of Egypt with great miracles and with an outstretched arm, divine intervention. That's why we do all these things on Pesach. That's number one. Number two, understand that every mitzvah we have, whether it's a chok, whether it's a mishpat, whether it's rational, irrational, whether it's symbolic or not symbolic, we may or may not understand, but it's all good. It's all from God. We trust that God only does good for us. It's God's tzedakah towards us. It's God's generosity to our people. He gives us all these mitzvahs. And then, so that's the end of the Torah's response. And then you open up your Haggadah, and the Haggadah tells you, and also, tell him something else too. Tell them the laws of Pesach. I mean, once you've given that introduction to your wise son, now it's time to get down to business. You teach him all the details of the Torah. You start from the beginning of the Seder and get all the way through to the end, the dessert after the Paschal lamb. You go through everything with him. Because the wise son is not open for learning. He's ready for business. So you tell the wise son all the complex details, all the intricate laws, give him all the information about the Haggadah, because he is wise, he's open for it, he's ready for it, you teach every child based on who they are, and you take him all the way to the end of the Seder, that teach him that even that final law, that after the Paschal Lamb, there's no dessert. That's your last thing you eat for the night, close your Haggadah, and we're done. So that's the approach to the wise son. Now, it's this interesting reference, allusion in this law, which is said. The law of the Haggadah points out. So we're saying that really the Haggadah is telling you, teach him everything. Once you give him the proper intro, proper approach to the mitzvot, like the Torah says, now start teaching him everything you can. He's your wise son. You want to be able to bring him up to his potential. And again, we're talking to ourselves as well, that we have within ourselves a wise part, which wants to know more and more and more, and always go deeper and deeper and deeper. So you want to bring that part of ourselves, or that child, up to their potential, and you teach them as much as you can. But the law pointed out, specifically here, is after the Paschal Lamb, there should be a dessert. So commentators point out, why is this the law that Haggadah chooses? Because there's a very deep reference here. I'm quoting now from the Haggadah I quoted a few weeks ago. It's called Yad Mitzrayim, The Hand of Egypt, written by Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Chaver. But this, I'm sure this idea appears elsewhere as well. The step in the Seder, which we eat our Fikomen, we call it Safun. And the Seder is 15 steps. It's a song. And we have Shulchan Orech is the meal. Safun is the Afikomen. And the Barech is when we say benching. We say the Berchas Hamazon, the grace after meals. So the step called Safun, literally Safun means hidden. And we understand because the custom is to hide the Afikomen. And now you take out the hidden Afikomen and you eat it. So we call it Safun. It's the hidden step of the Seder. That was the point in the times of the Temple, the Beis HaMikdash, and they'd eat the Paschal Lamb. We eat Afikomen instead. But they would eat the Paschal Lamb as their dessert. After they had their meal, the law was you're supposed to eat the Paschal Lamb when you're full. So you have your whole meal, and they bring out the lamb chops. So it was actually, we picture the Paschal Lamb as their main course, but really they eat other things first, and once they were full, they bring out the Paschal Lamb. Now what's the idea? And what's the idea of Safun? So the idea of Safun is hidden. We refer to the reward in the world to come as hidden reward. There's a verse in the prophets, Ma Rav Tufka, how great is the goodness, Asher Safanta, that you've hidden away, that same word, Safun, Safanta, you've hidden away, L'Recha, for those who fear you. So there's great reward in the world to come for those who fear God. And that reward is referred to as Safun, something hidden away. That's how the prophets refer to that reward. And the reference of the Afikomen is that the reward we have in the future, so right now, we don't have it. It's something that there's a world to come. We believe in an eternal reward in the world to come. And as we are living our lives here in this world, we don't have that reward quite yet. So it's hidden away from us. In the beginning of the Seder, you take your matzah, you break it, you stick away a little bit for later. So you have your matzah for now. That's what we have in this world. But there's a piece of matzah which is hidden away for later. And that piece of matzah, the Afikomen, also corresponding to the Paschal Lamb, that represents the reward in the world to come. That reward which we don't have right now, which is hidden away for the future. We get to that step in the Seder, so we've lived through the entire Seder through the meal. And at the very end of the meal, we eat something which represents our eternal reward in the world to come. That's what the Afikomen represents. And there's no dessert after that, because the world, when you have your final reward in the world to come, you are totally satiated. There's nothing after that. That's your eternal reward. That's the reward which is going to satisfy you for the future. It's total satisfaction. The reason we have dessert is because we're not totally satisfied. We want something more, something tastier, something sweeter. When we have our ultimate reward and world to come, we're going to be satisfied for eternity. There's nothing after that. So the piece of the Paschal Lamb, or as we do it, the Afikomen presents, we're eating our final reward. And therefore, symbolically, at that point, there's nothing after that anymore, because the final reward we have world to come, that represents total satisfaction. There's nothing else to do, nothing else to get. We are there. We've reached our goal. And that's what the Afikomen represents. So, on a deep level, when you tell the wise son, even the law that don't eat dessert after your Afikomen, or don't eat dessert after your Paschal Lamb, what we're telling the wise son is that you have to know that all the mitzvahs that we do ultimately lead us to reward. Because all mitzvahs are about God's will, and God rewards and punishes, and ultimately whatever you do good is God's generosity towards us, that He will give us good eternally. As we said, the Torah tells us in the response that everything that God tells us is good, all the mitzvahs are good for us, they're all beneficial, and they all give us eternal reward. So you tell them symbolically, when you have that Paschal Lamb, understand that that represents eternal reward, and you're going to be totally satisfied at that point. You won't need a dessert after that. as good as the desserts may be, no dessert. Because that's going to be, because that's the best dessert you're ever going to have is your reward in the world to come. So that's the deep reference here in the response of the wise son. So that's how we would compare and contrast the Torah's response to the wise son and the Haggadah's response. Now let's move on to the wicked son. So if you're on page 11 in the Haggadah, what does the wicked child ask? What does this service mean for you? So let's analyze the question first, and then we'll see the answer. So the way the Torah words this, let's get the exact reference here. Now this is in Exodus 12, Shmos Yud Beis. And the way that this question is worded indicates that it's the question of a wicked son. Now why is that? There's a few reasons why. Number one, I think I mentioned this last time we met. It's the way that the verse quotes it is V'haya ki yomra lechem v'lechem. It will be when your children say to you, Ma'avod azos lechem. What is this work, this service to you? So the way the Torah presents the question, it's not a question, it's a statement. They say to you. When it comes to the other sons, the Torah says, Kish alcha bincha, shoel, to ask, when your son asks you. Asking means that I want a response, I'm curious, I want to know. But this is ki yomru, when they declare to you. Because the wicked son is not interested in the response. The wicked son has an agenda. The wicked son is trying to cause you problems, to annoy you, to bother you, to create doubts in your mind. So he declares to you, what's all this work? What's all this avodah? What's all this service you're doing? That's number one. So that already indicates the wicked son. Number two is he calls it avodah. Avodah is a term which means work. In Egypt, we were avadim, we were slaves. And avodah, it seems to denote toil. And the implication of the question of the wicked son is that, again, many commentators point this out, that this is useless work. Why do you go through this whole process of Pesach? It's so hard. You know, it's so. Some commentators point out, even it sounds funny, but they say, I want to eat. You know, why is the seder taking so long? Come ready to eat my meal. You know, if you're sitting there, you have your matzah and your maror and this whole story, and you're eating karpas, and you're doing all these things. Well, why are you going through all this? Let's just have dinner. Or in a bigger picture, why are you going through all this toil? What do you gain out of it? And at that point, he's being a heretic because he is denying divine reward and punishment, and he's denying the divine intervention at that point because he's saying this is all useless. As he said, the response to the wise son is, you have to know, my dear son, that God, everything God commands you is good, and it leads to eternal reward. And it's good for you. It's God's generosity. We have Torah and we have the mitzvos. The wicked son says it's useless. There's no benefits out of this. You're just wasting your time, wasting your effort. You're delaying this great meal to do all these interesting and strange acts. It's avodah, it's just useless toil, useless labor. That's all a statement of heresy. That's what it is. He's denying the principles of the Torah. So, and it's in direct contrast to the response to the wise son. The wise son, we say, it's all good for us. Everything we do is good. The wicked son, he says, it's useless. There's nothing you're getting from this. It's all just, you know, it's all just meaningless acts, meaningless work. One of the commentaries, the Rukeach, points out something I think we're all guilty of. Is that based on this, we should be very careful not to complain about preparations for Pesach. Because the wicked son, he says, what's all this work you're doing? It's all this toil, it's too hard, it's, you know, what's it worth? So then we sit there and we complain about it's so hard for us, we have to clean the house, and we have to get out our dishes, we have to bake our matzahs, and we have to, you know, get the Seder ready. So we're essentially acting as the wicked son himself says, that it's all just useless toil, it's too much. So he says, be careful not to complain about getting for Pesach. Because if we complain too much about getting for Pesach, then we're actually emulating in some way the wicked son. But that's another way in which we understand this is a wicked son's question. Number one, it's a declaration, not a question. And number two, it's because he calls it a avodah. He says, it's just work, it's useless work. Also, as the Haggadah points out, the wicked son, he says, what's this all to you? Meaning, it's not relevant to me. Because he separates from the community, as the Haggadah says. He doesn't mention God either. The other sons mention God. You know, why did God command us in these mitzvos? He doesn't mention God here. He just says, what are you doing all this work for? That's all he says. So these are all indications of the wicked son's question. And then, furthermore, the Chassam Sofer points out that if you contrast the wicked son and the wise son's question, the wicked son says, Havoda Hazos. Why are you doing this work right over here? Meaning right now, he sees in front of him a Seder. He sees a paschal lamb, or he sees matzah, he says, I don't want anything to do with this. It's the actual time of the mitzvah. He says, unless you give me a good reason, I'm not doing it. I need to have a good rationale for what you're doing, or else I'm out of here. The wise son understands that his questions aren't going to impact his observance. We observe the mitzvahs because God said to observe the mitzvahs. My questioning, my understanding, okay, that's secondary. And when I'm involved in the mitzvah, having good rationale is not going to affect my performance. But, you know, I have to understand. So out, when I'm outside the Seder, I'll try to understand it. You know, I'll talk about it. I'll analyze it. But the wicked son says, what are you doing all this for right in front of me? Right now, I'm at the Seder. And why are you doing all that? I don't want to get involved. Unless you convince me one way or the other, I'm not doing it. Because the answers will affect his observance. And we never want the answers to affect our observance. Yeah.
If he were that wicked, he would leave the table. Why he doesn't leave the table?
Because I think sometimes people who are wicked, they want to toss it back in your face. He wants to be there, but he wants to do it only to get across his point. He has an agenda.
But his question seems to indicate he still wants some clarification. I mean,
well, that's what I was pointing out before, because when the Torah presents it, it's not a question, it's a statement.
He's not that Lasha.
I don't know. I mean, again, the Torah says he didn't ask you a question. He declares it to you. If he's interested in a discussion, it'll be a question. But the Torah says it's not a question. It's a declaration. That it has nothing to do with me.
It looks like a question because he says, what is this?
Right.
But the Torah presents it. He doesn't ask you saying. He says to you saying, meaning he's asking it in a challenging way.
Yeah, it's not a question.
And in challenging, he's not saying, he's not asking to learn what it is. He's actually saying, what are you doing? This is worthless.
Right.
It's a little interpretive.
It certainly is interpretive, but that's what we do in the Torah. We interpret the words exactly as they are.
You don't forgive the Hashem.
We don't forgive him. Well, it's not a question of forgiving or not, but it's a question of defining who this person is. Now, there is a response to him. We'll talk about the response. Even the response is pretty harsh, the way we'll understand it. But again, if somebody wants to have the Torah and the rabbis, if someone wants to have an intellectual conversation, you can be as challenging as you want, but if you're open to discussing into a give and take, and you're looking for truth, then the Torah respects that. But someone who's not open to a discussion, and they're not searching for truth, so the Torah says there's no reason to deal with that person. If you want to discuss, you want to have some intellectual give and take, you're interested in knowing the truth, that's fine. But the Rasha, the wicked son here, seems to not be interested in even knowing the truth. He has his own agenda, and based on that, he challenges you. He tries to create doubts in your mind, but he's not interested in having any sort of intellectual, honest discussion. And that's how the commentators understand the question of the Rasha, of the wicked son. So the way the Torah responds to the wicked son, I'll read to you this again in Exodus chapter 12, verse 27. Vemartem, you should say, Zevach Pesach Hul Hashem, this is the paschal lamb, paschal sacrifice for Hashem, Asher Pasach Abati Ben Yisrael Ben Mitzrayim, who skipped over our homes in Egypt when he afflicted the Egyptians, and he saved our households, and the nation all bowed down to God. So that was the response to the wicked son. The Haggadah's response is a little bit different than that. The Haggadah's response is again bottom of page 11. First, the Haggadah says, by the word you, it is clear that the questioning child is not self-inclusive, and so has withdrawn from the community. So we see he excludes himself by saying, Ma avodah hazos lachem, what's this all to you? That's not relevant to me. But why are you doing it? It doesn't make any sense. So he's already removed himself from the community. He's already separated himself from the Jewish people. It is therefore proper to respond forcefully. So we respond forcefully. The Hebrew here is, again, totally lost in translation. The Hebrew is ve'af atahake eshinov. You should, again, the word af there also, meaning the word af will again indicate that we, of course, we say what the Torah says to respond, but also do the following. Also, Hakeshina, blunt his teeth, is the literal translation, and tell him, Bavor zeh asah shel li b'tzeis Mitzrayim, this is done because what the Eternal did for me when I went out of Egypt, for me and not for you, not for the youngster, it says, not for him. For had this child been there, there would not have been a redemption for this one. He would not have been redeemed. So, again, we're going to use that word af to say, you should say exactly as the Torah says to do, the word af also in the Hebrew. But then also you should respond by blunting his teeth. We'll explain what that means in a minute. And respond forcefully that had he been in Egypt, he wouldn't have been saved. So let's understand the Torah's response to him first. The Torah responds, you should say, that this is the Zevach Pesach, this is the Paschal sacrifice for Hashem. The commentaries point out that the Torah doesn't say to him. The Torah says you should declare. You should, but it doesn't say respond to the child. When it comes to the other children, it says you should respond to your son. Respond to him. Here it doesn't say respond to him. It says just answer. You should declare. You should say this out loud. And commentaries point out that what the Torah is doing here is saying that you don't respond to him. Somebody who is that challenging, somebody who is creating such a tension, he has such a malicious intent, you don't have to deal with him. There's a verse in Proverbs, Altan Kasil Kivalto. You don't have to respond to a fool with his foolishness. I mean, if he's interested in a discussion, that's fine. But if he's just trying to challenge me and he's acting foolish, then there's no reason to respond to him. But what do? First, we respond out loud the reason why we're doing what we're doing. We don't want his challenge to affect our belief in God. So we declare to ourselves that, no, I tell myself, this is a Zevach Pesach Lashem. This is the Paschal Lamb for God who saved us in Egypt, and I have to reaffirm my own beliefs. That's first and foremost. So the response isn't to him, according to the Torah. It's a declaration for ourselves. And that's why I didn't say respond to him. It says declare for yourself, this is the Zevach Pesach Lashem. This is the Paschal Lamb for God. That's number one. That's what the Torah tells us to do. Now, some commentaries point out that the response given in the Haggadah is actually a borrowed response from the child who does not know how to ask. If you look what the Torah presents the child who doesn't know how to ask, this is what it tells the child. Bavor zeh, this is done because what the Eternal did for me when I went out of Egypt. Because the Torah is saying there's a vulnerable child right there. This child doesn't know how to ask. He's vulnerable. And we don't want him to be influenced by the wicked son. So number one, we declare for ourselves to reaffirm our own beliefs. And then we take aside the vulnerable child. The poor child does not have a background, doesn't know how to ask quite yet, and we speak to him. And we tell the vulnerable child, that one who does not know how to ask, we tell him that we do all this because God took us out of Egypt, and had he been there, had your wicked brother been there, he wouldn't have been redeemed. He wouldn't have been redeemed there. Why? Why wouldn't he have been redeemed? So again, the Haggadah Yad Mitzrayim, we put it before, he points out that what is the approach of the wicked son? He's saying that this is all meaningless toil. Because God doesn't really intervene in the world. God doesn't care what you do. There's no divine intervention, no divine providence. So it's all useless. God doesn't really care. So the response is, well, if you approach God in that way, God will respond to you in the same exact way. If you act as if God doesn't know, then God acts with you in the same way as if He'll act as if He doesn't know. So if you want to have a miracle occur to you, you want to be freed from Egypt, well, you have to believe in God, in God's divine hand, in God's divine intervention. But you, wicked son, you don't believe that God intervenes in the world. You don't believe in reward and punishment. You don't believe that God cares about your actions. So God will ignore you as you ignore him. And that's what we tell, that's why he wouldn't have been redeemed in Egypt. There's a verse which is in the it's Parshas Kisavo in the book of Devarim. It says, Valachna imi keri, if you walk to me in a way we refer to as keri, in a way that everything is just happenstance, coincidental. So God says, I'll walk with you in the same way. If you want to walk with me, if you want to act in life as if you believe in God, you trust in God, you believe, you have emunah, you have bitachon, you have faith in God, so then God will respond to you in that same way. And he's going to take care of you, he's going to lead you in the right path. But if you walk with God in a way the Torah describes as carry, in a way which is just as if everything is kind of this coincidence, kind of happens, kind of goes with the flow, so God says, I'll respond to you in the same way, and you're not going to get any miracles. You won't find my hand in your life. You're not going to see any divine providence. So the God responds to us as we respond to him. It's kind of like there's a famous idea, a Hasidic idea, it says, Hashem Tzilcha, God is like your shadow. And the way you act with God, God responds to you in that same way. You act with belief in God, God responds to you with miracles and with divine intervention. You act in a way which you say God doesn't care, and then God acts back and he doesn't care also. And that's how we view, God takes a cue from us in many ways, based on how we act, he'll act with us in that same way. Very interesting. So the Hebrew here is that you should blunt his teeth. Hakishino, blunt his teeth. So what's he to blunt his teeth? So one commentary, the Ritva, one of the early commentators, he says, again, it's kind of cute, but he says that part of the Rasha's problem here, the wicked son's problem, is that he wants to eat his meal, and we're doing all these things and delaying the meal. So those teeth want to eat dinner. So you say, those teeth want to eat dinner, knock those teeth out. You say, your teeth want to eat dinner, you take it as a way. That's what he actually says it means. I don't know if it really means punch him in the face, but it means that those same teeth want to eat dinner. You got to respond harshly to those teeth. Yeah.
In Tehillim, there's a
I think it is. This is Shine Rishayim Shibarta. You break the teeth of the wicked. I'll tell you a very interesting gematria in a second, which seems to fit into that. But that's what the Ritva says. The others say it's a halach response. Somebody who's a heretic is not allowed to partake of the Paschal Lamb. So we tell the Rasha that if you have that attitude, and you deny divine intervention, so those teeth can't eat the Paschal Lamb. You're forbidden to eat it. Because even someone who's Jewish, if they're considered a kofir, somebody who's heretical, which has its definitions what that means, but they would not be allowed to partake of the Paschal Lamb. So it's a halachic definition that at this point, those teeth are not to be blunted. They can't eat the lamb. You can also say it means, when I say I blunt your teeth, so sometimes, even in English, we talk about somebody who has a very, very sharp bite. You know, that comment had really had a bite to it. It was a very sharp comment. So we try to take to kind of blunt his comment. We say, you're a very sharp comment, listen to me. I'm going to respond to you. But it's actually interesting gematria. The numerical value of Russia, wicked, is 570. You can do the math or just trust me on this one. It's 570. The numerical value of tzaddik, someone who's righteous, is 204. The difference between the two, 570 and 204, the difference is 366. The word here used for his teeth, shinav, is 366. So we say, knock out the teeth of the Rasha. What you do is you take the Rasha, you knock out that 366, and now it goes down to 204. It becomes a tzaddik. So that's this. So if you followed that, the Rasha is 570. If you take out his teeth, the gematria of his teeth is 366. 570 minus 366 is 204, which leaves you with the gematria of tzaddik, of righteous. So you do what you can. So we're talking about knocking out the teeth of the wicked, which again is a recurring theme in Tehillim. So the gematria is just to do with is we take out the teeth of the wicked, they become righteous. That's the numerical value of those words. There's one other point about teeth, is that what do teeth do? Teeth take. You got that? Teeth take something which is whole, and they break it into small pieces. That's what teeth do. It's actually symbolic of idolatry versus monotheism. We believe in one God. But teeth break one piece into many, many pieces, which is symbolic of idolatry. So when we talk about the wicked, we talk about their teeth, because the role of teeth is to take one unit and break it into many units, which is all symbolic of avodah zarah, of idolatry, and of polytheism instead of monotheism. So quickly, just running out of time, let's quickly talk about the Tam, the simple and the one who does not know to ask. The Tam is actually the only one you have the same response in the Torah as in the Haggadah. Concerning the Tam, the Torah says, your son will again, Yishalcha, ask you. This is in Shmos, chapter 13, verse 14. He'll ask you, okay, he's not declaring, he wants to know, he's asking you a question, an honest question. And he asks you, what is this? It's not as intricate as the wise son's question. It's a very simple question. What's going on here? The wise son says, I know that there's statutes and there's laws. He says, what's going on in front of me? Something interesting is happening here. So the Torah responds, and we respond the same way in the Haggadah. You tell him, again, the response is to him here, as opposed to the wicked son, you just declare. But for the simple son, you respond to him. With a mighty arm, God took us out of Egypt. And that's exactly what the Haggadah says. You say, with a mighty hand did the Eternal bring us out of Egypt. It's on page 13 in the Maxwell House Haggadah, from the house of slavery. So when it comes to the simple son, the Torah and Haggadah line up exactly. Then the fourth son, and just the idea of the simple son is, like we mentioned a few weeks ago, that the simple son is somebody who is not proactively searching, but if you spark his interest, he'll ask the question. Also, there is a concept of serving God in a simple way. I mean, sometimes there's kind of like this, you know, implicit trust we have in God. We don't have to delve into all the facts. You know, we serve God in a way which is kind of, we call it in Hebrew, it's tamimus, it's called, being tamim, being kind of, the word simple in English doesn't have that a Greek connotation. It sounds like he's kind of silly, but the idea of being Tam, it says Yaakov was Ish Tam. Yaakov was one of the greatest of our patriarchs. He's called Ish Tam. He was Tam. Which means it's something which is a total trust that you don't have to understand everything. Just you serve God with, you know, this certain purity, certain innocence. That's how you do the Tam. So the commentaries point out that the simple child doesn't necessarily mean that he's simple, that he's not smart. But it means that he's there's innocence there, which he serves God with pure faith. We can even call it blind faith in some ways, without having to question, having to inquire. But even he asks sometimes, what's going on around me? I have to understand what's happening in front of me, what's going on in front of me. and respond that God took us out of Egypt, and that's why we do all these things. And that suffices for him. He doesn't need to know all the details and the intricacies of the halacha. You tell him, God took us out of Egypt, so we do all these things. He says, great, I'll do it. Sounds good to me. And then the final son mentioned is Enu de Elishol, who does not know how to ask. And this is quoting from, again, it's in the book of Shmos. And this is chapter 13, verse 7, which I have over here. And in chapter 30, verse 7 in the book of Shmos, there does not mention any questions. It just mentions teaching your children. Let me find it. 13:7. Where is it? 13:8. The God to the mental, you should tell your son. So this is without a question. There's no question preceding this in the Torah. Torah just tells you, tell your son on that day, saying, because of this, God took me out of Egypt. So we see there's an idea of proactively teaching somebody who doesn't even ask. Whether the person does not know how to ask, has no background to ask, is too young to ask, or as we mentioned a few weeks ago, is not interested in asking. The wicked son, he's there, but he's asking in a way which is creating tension, which is not interested in the answer. Some people just aren't interested at all. They just don't, you know, just it's not relevant to me. I'm not getting involved. So we have a mitzvah to, again, whether it be based on ignorance, based on an attitude, or based on mental capacity, whatever it is, we have a mitzvah to go and proactively teach those who don't even ask the question on Pesach night. And that's coming back to the point, which we've discussed before, that the story of the Exodus is so important, so fundamental, we have to make sure every Jew knows this story. Even the Jew who does not know how to ask me the question, I still have to be able to answer them. That's how important it is. The word I use in the Haggadah is at the Sachlo, you should open it for them. Meaning if they don't ask you the question, you still open the topic. There's a way of opening up the topic for them. Which some say means get them to ask a question. If they don't ask you naturally, you have to go and somehow draw out the question in some way. Which is one concept we have on Pesach. We do a lot of some things with the Seder. We're supposed to just kind of ignite questioning. Just to inspire questioning. But you should, Psachlo, you open up for that person. You don't wait for the question. Sometimes you just need a response without being questioned. And it's pointed out that this is the only mitzvah in the whole Torah that we are obligated to teach the reasons for. Other mitzvahs, we teach the children how to do mitzvahs. You teach a child, this is how you pray, these are tefillin, this is a shofar, this is a lulav, this is how you keep kosher. But we have no obligation to explain why. We might do it anyways, but they can figure out why as they get older. When it comes to Pesach, we have an obligation to explain the whys as well. Because the meaning of these mitzvahs is so important, so fundamental. You can't just say, eat the matzah. You have an obligation to explain, even if the child doesn't even ask you. You have to explain why you're eating matzah. And why you're eating the bitter herbs. And why you're eating the Paschal lamb. You have to explain it because these are the fundamentals of Judaism. And no Jew can be left without knowing these fundamentals. Whether they ask or not. So we'll close with this. But overall, we have these four children. And again, every single one of us, we have all four aspects. Part of us is very inquisitive, very curious, we want to absorb information. Part of us, we just want to challenge, we want to fight back, we want to poke fun at things, because, you know, we have part of ourselves just cynical, and we're not interested in involving ourselves. Part of us just wants to step back and just not be involved. Part of us is very simple. Part of us say, I can't deal with all this complexity, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. Part of us, we have that part of ourselves as well. And then we have a part of ourselves which doesn't even know what question to ask. And all four parts of ourselves have to be approached at the Seder. There's four different types of people, and there's four parts of ourselves. And it's our obligation for people of all ages to make sure that the fundamentals of Judaism which come out of the Seder are absorbed by our entire being. And that's our obligation at our Seder.
Is Rasha atheist?
Is he what?
Atheist.
Is he atheist? Not necessarily atheist. They say he might deny divine intervention and reward and punishment. Doesn't necessarily deny God.
Why is no daughter?
You know, the Torah uses the son as a generic term. That's, you know...
General.
Yeah, that's, you know, as English to English did till the past 15 years also. I mean, the masculine is used as the generic way of explaining it. It doesn't mean son versus daughter. A woman is just as obligated to say as a man is. There's no... A lot of mitzvahs have the distinction between men and women with the Seder. It's the exact same. Men and women are the same at the Seder. It's something no Jew can be left behind at the Seder. That's how we do it.
No Jew left behind.
I wish everybody Chag Kosher V'Sameach, a happy and kosher Pesach. And God willing, we'll meet again after Pesach in 3 Tuesdays from now. Yeah.